It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And since the last time we talked, there are actually baseball players doing baseball things on baseball fields, and there's also continuing transactions. So we have a lot to talk about. At the end, we are also going to talk about the Labor Mixed League Expert Draft, and we're going to start talking about outfield ranks. So we have a whole lot to get to today. But we will start with some news. And the first news, unfortunately, is bad, and that is Alex Reyes out for the year, gonna have elbow surgery. Bad news for baseball fans, bad news for the Cardinals. We talk fantasy here, and so it raises some fantasy questions. And the Cardinals are a good team. They're probably going to score a pretty good number of runs. They're probably going to have a pretty good bullpen, and so it's a pretty good opportunity for a starter. So with all that said, Fred, what is your level of interest in Michael Wacha, given that he apparently has a better path towards starting than he did a week ago?
Yeah, I mean, we had already heard some speculation that maybe even if Reyes had been healthy, they might have started him in the minor leagues. But I think now Wacha should be in the rotation. I don't think I would draft him in a 10-team league, but in a 12-team league, I don't mind him late.
What do you think the upside is for Wacha? Because he's kind of a hard guy to figure. You know, he came up through the minors, and he was considered a high-floor, low-ceiling guy. He was considered that on draft day. He really exploded on the scene his rookie year. But since then, you know, his ratios, even in good years, haven't been that great. Good ERA, but a steady about 1-2 whip even in good years. Good bit under a strikeout per inning. But he's still young. You can see the stuff. He's kind of a guy that you can wish cast a little bit, and if you wanted to talk yourself into upside, you could see it. But I think there's also a pretty convincing case to be made that his ceiling is pretty low. I think we know where the floor is, and I think we know what the appeal is. How high do you think the ceiling is with Wacha?
Yeah, I don't think the ceiling's very high. I like to think about, you know, which categories could the pitcher actually really help you in or be special in. And I guess we've seen him produce, as you said, low ERAs, and the Cardinals could, you know, they have pitcher-friendly home park and a good team and everything. Like, maybe he could have a 3.5 ERA or something a little below that, but his K per nine rate's going to be mediocre or below average. And we haven't really seen him produce a low whip over an extended period of time. So his whip's probably going to be north of 1.2, and wins are fickle. So that's why I think he's kind of capped as a late round. I can't get excited really about Wacha, but if he's healthy and things are going well, he is, you know, a back-end starter in maybe even a 10-team league and definitely a 12-team league.
So let's throw another wrench in here, because there's another interesting development that's been sort of bandied about here. Our Jennifer Langosch, among others, has reported that Trevor Rosenthal apparently is going to get a look as a potential starter. This is something the Cardinals have done before. Going back to my days there, they moved Braden Looper from a pretty successful reliever to actually a shockingly decent starting pitcher. It's an interesting idea. I'm not sure I buy it, in part because Rosenthal wasn't that great as a minor league starter, and I think that's why he ended up in the bullpen. But the stuff is obvious. Maybe the reps help him refine his command. Does he intrigue you at all as any kind of a flyer in any format?
I guess in an NL only, I would pick him. I mean, late in an NL only, I would pick him and then just you kind of see what happened. I don't see a scenario. Maybe you do. I'm not sure. I don't know. But I don't see a scenario where the Cardinals don't deal with an additional injury and somehow he still gets in the rotation. I can't see him in the rotation ahead of Wacha or ahead of Lance Lynn unless one of those pitchers, you know, starts the year on the disabled list, you know, or really something's really wrong during spring training. And then I don't know what the Cardinals do with him at that point. Like, they won't send him the minors, so then even if he's stretched out, I think he just goes to the bullpen and then he's not stretched out after a few weeks anymore. So, I don't know. I mean, his strikeout rate was so good as a reliever that you could project some upside if he was to be a starting pitcher. I mean, his strikeout rate would probably go down, but it could be at least 9, if not more than that. But his control was so inconsistent even in the bullpen, and I don't know. I don't think I would take him consider him really in a mixed league.
No, I'd have to see it. I mean, the one thing I would throw in here is when you've got a guy like that who's been a big part of your success, you don't often experiment with a guy like that and not follow through with it. I think there is something to be sort of taken here that, I mean, look, Trevor Rosenthal is not Adam Wainwright. He's not a core guy. But I think that once you make it public and once you sort of start talking about it, it's a pretty good indicator that you're serious about it, because this early in camp, there are any number of ways to disguise or talk about it obliquely where you can stretch him out and put him in a position that if you wanted him to start, you could do it without actually making it obvious you were considering him as a starter. So I don't want to read too much into it, but I don't think that it gets to be this kind of known unless they're taking it pretty seriously.
Yeah, for sure. And there may be a way, too, where, you know, he doesn't open the season in the rotation, but they keep him in the bullpen as a multi-inning reliever. And, you know, if they need him at some point during the first half, then they, you know, his first start's only four innings or three, yeah. Three and a third or something, and then they build him up. Like, it's possible that he does make some starts this season.
We move to a significantly less injured starter, but actually something of a parallel to Michael Wacha as well. Chris Tillman has a shoulder issue. He had a shoulder issue last year. He did not have a good start in the wild card game. And when he ramped it up again, it started feeling problematic again. Now, to give proper due to everybody down there in Sarasota, everybody is saying, basically, we're not worried. Tillman is saying, this is fine, I'm going to be fine, we're just taking it easy. The Orioles are essentially saying the same thing. But it's always worrisome to me when a guy ends the year with some kind of injury, takes his regular offseason, comes back, and it's still a problem. You mix that with the fact that shoulders are always scary. The Orioles are basically waving a light yellow flag on Tillman. My flag is, for him personally, is full yellow and not yet red, but I've kind of got the red poised and ready to wave it. Where are you on Tillman with this news?
Yeah, I'm concerned as well, and I like what you said about, you know, when they end a season with an injury and then return basically with the same injury on day one. And for me, it's also concerning when in the middle of February a team's telling you, you know, oh, this isn't a big deal, but we can already tell you in about 8 weeks he's not going to be ready to start. And for me, I like you mentioning kind of the comparison between Wacha and Tillman, as far as neither one has a high ceiling. But for me, Tillman's ceiling is so low with him in the AL East and with that home park. Like, I don't see really much likelihood. I know he's done it before, but I don't see much likelihood that he produces a low 3 ZRA. So if you think high 3s or even a 4 ERA, something low 4 ZRA, mediocre strikeout rate, a fairly high whip, you know, it's just not even worth dealing with the injury. So now for me, he's off all mixed league draft lists, even 15 team. He has to be drafted in AL only, but, you know, more in the later rounds.
We move to a couple of free agent sluggers. Mike Napoli joins Texas. Now, I was way down on Napoli coming out of the postseason. We were both pretty down on him. I rate him up a level or two with Texas. I like that fit a lot. I like the ballpark. I still think he's more a complimentary piece than somebody I'm counting on, but I do like that fit. He's had success there before. Again, it's a really good place to hit. Napoli goes from, you know, with someplace like Cleveland, a guy I really would have very little interest in, to a guy I could see a late-round flyer on. What does the move do for your evaluation of him?
Yeah, to me it kind of solidifies. I don't see anything close to a repeat, and I know we've talked about that before this offseason, but to me it kind of solidifies him as a good candidate for about 25 homers, about 80 RBIs. And yeah, even with the power surge across baseball last season, that still makes him someone you draft in a 12-team league for sure, and even in a 10-team league, like, in the later rounds. So yeah, that's how I feel. Like, this home park and this lineup that he's in, that solidifies. I don't see now like an enormous drop off to the point where he's just sitting on waivers across almost every mixed league. So while I don't expect to repeat it, I think he can be fine.
And while we're talking about one-dimensional right-handed sluggers, Chris Carter is officially a Yankee as of this morning. Press release just landed in my inbox within the last hour or so. And I like Carter, and I like the fit in Yankee Stadium a lot. For all we talk about left-handers there, it has actually played as a very friendly park for right-handed power as well. So I like the fit, but there are just a zillion players. Even this is the amazing thing. You remove Teixeira and A-Rod, and there just still seem to be more players than at-bats to go around at the corner and DH spots in Yankee land. So it's sort of a question of, as much as performance, who you think is going to get the opportunities. Do you like Carter? Do you like Bird? Do you like Tyler Austin? Does all of this affect your valuation of Matt Holliday in any way? Because he probably figured mostly for DH, and that you got to think this might eat into some of his at-bats.
Yeah, I think the biggest change for me probably was Holliday. I kind of felt, I don't know, I'm still a little optimistic on Bird. I still feel like if Bird's healthy, because the Yankees are, they're not in a classic rebuild, but a little bit of a rebuild, that I still think he needs to be their first baseman against right-handed pitching. So his value to me hasn't changed a lot. Carter's value to me has dropped a lot, in the sense of we just can't pin down a way that he starts five games a week. I could see him starting a game or two a week at first base and a couple games a week at DH. So his value has gone down a lot. Holliday's value, though, has gone down for me a little bit, just because he's an older player, and it may be wise for the Yankees to give him a couple days off a week with Carter going in. But if you start taking Holliday, who was a little bit marginal as far as a 10- or 12-team league and his value already, and if you drop him down to four starts a week, now he's off rosters in those leagues, unless they're willing to put Holliday in the outfield sometimes, and then maybe it impacts Aaron Judge. I mean, Holliday played in the outfield all the time last season, so there's no reason he couldn't go to the outfield a couple days a week.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing to me, is to some extent, it's at least a slight ding on virtually every corner player they have, with the exception of Chase Headley. Like, it's just, and Gardner, but, you know, it's they're just a lot of guys for not that many spots and a limited number of at-bats, and I think you kind of wait and see. But for me, again, yeah, I think the point you make is pretty much everybody, Judge, Bird, Austin, Holliday, Carter, all five guys in this mix, their fantasy value takes a little bit of a hit relative to before Carter came to the Yankees.
Yeah, and I will say that I've often find over the years, if you have one too many players, but it's over a lot of spots, these things do work themselves out. So I kind of, my immediate reaction with Carter was, well, you can't draft him in a mixed league anymore. He doesn't really have a path to playing time. But we could be looking at any point, an injury to Bird or an injury to Holliday or an injury to Judge, or Judge striking out so often that they need to return him to the minors for a while, you know, or an injury to Gardner, and then they put Holliday in the outfield more and Carter plays more. Like, there's a lot of players there that if any of them are on the disabled list by May, you know, all the rest of them can have the roles that we were expecting them to have.
Yep. And that's, again, why I think that the point you made is really key, which is that Holliday may be the one guy who really kind of suffers here, because I don't think they want to play him in the outfield. If they have to, they will. I don't think they want to do that. And I think that essentially it's those right-handed DH at-bats that get it eaten into more than anything. I don't see Carter playing that much first. He could, but I don't really see it happening a lot. So I do think that if there's one guy who gets hurt most, aside from Carter himself, because we kind of thought if he signed somewhere, he'd have a real opportunity, it's Holliday. Brandon Phillips is now an Atlanta Brave and is going to have all the opportunity, because turns out that Sean Rodriguez apparently will be out for the season, our Mark Bowman reports. So Phillips has been, for a guy who the team's been trying to give away, has been pretty good the past couple of years. Hit for some average, hit for some power, kind of been an across-the-board, a quiet asset. Not that Brandon Phillips has ever quiet anything, but I kind of like him to keep that up in Atlanta. I think he's a sneaky late-round pick to sort of fill a spot and be effective.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, I mean, he's leaving a hitter-friendly park, and we don't really know exactly how SunTrust Park is going to play, but assuming that it's not really pitcher-friendly, I don't know. There's a park drop-off there, but power isn't a really big part of his game. I mean, he's kind of that across-the-board guy. He doesn't really dominate any category, but it's a nice average and double-digit totals and homers and steals. And I think he can do that in Atlanta. From what I've seen early returns, it looks like he might hit sixth. You know, maybe he drives in 70 runs, scores about 65. He's been pretty durable. Yeah, he's nothing to get excited about, but in a 10-team league, I don't know if I'd draft him. In a 12-team league, though, I would. I'd take him in the later rounds. I think he's fine in there. I don't think this is a hit. I don't think it's really a big change in his value. Overall, maybe it bumps him up a couple percents in my eyes.
The one thing I would say about the ballpark, as you know, we do not know how Atlanta's going to play, but history suggests that Atlanta tends to be a pretty good place to hit the ball. You play at altitude. Not certainly not Denver or even Phoenix altitude, but it's a little bit raised. It's you get a little bit of that boost from the altitude. It's warm, so it's a pretty good place to hit. So we don't know exactly how the ballpark is going to play, but just as an aside here, I do think that it's safe to assume that it's probably going to be a pretty good place to hit. It may not be a bandbox, but if I had to guess how SunTrust Park is going to play, my guess is that it's probably going to be a pretty decent place to hit.
Yeah, I could see that for sure. And early returns that I've heard other people talking about it, they say looking at the dimensions, I don't get too deep into this until a park's really open and actively being used. But they say the dimensions look like it'll be a little more favorable for hitters than Turner Field was.
One more piece of news before we move on. Wilson Ramos, kind of a hard guy to read because he's probably not going to catch until midseason, but he's still talking about the club still holding out some hope that maybe by May he could do some DHing. I don't know. I think that'll be an interesting challenge for them to manage because you signed this guy for a couple of years, and I think they want him to be their catcher next year, but they also need the help. So that's going to be a tough line to walk. As Ramos sort of goes through his rehab, does he hold any interest, any mixed league interest to you at all?
Not much. 15 team, like two catcher league, then yeah, because in a 15 team two catcher league, you're going 30 catchers deep, and just it would be worth holding him. Even if I'm really not expecting that we'll be talking about him on this podcast in May as a Wilson Ramos is returning. What should we do with him? I really think that it'll be later than that. But in that kind of league, I would even a 12 team two catcher league. Maybe if I had DL slots, I guess, then he's worth stashing. But my hopes are pretty low for this season. And we've talked about him a little bit before in the sense of he had a really good year last year, and not to knock that at all, but he isn't Buster Posey. He isn't someone who year in, year out is a top flight, has been a top flight fantasy catcher. And we can say for sure when he comes back, he's going to be that again. Like there is also the possibility that he comes back and is just okay.
Yeah, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is, you know, who knows how his base is going to be with a questionable knee or whether he trusts his knee. So, yeah, it's a perfectly fair point. I like the player a lot. I put some value in the vision aspect that he really kind of found something when he was able to see again. But, yeah, I think it's perfectly reasonable to be very cautious with him as we go forward. That wraps up the news. Before we move on, we want to take a moment to tell you about the StatCast podcast, a show dedicated to the analytics that drive front office decisions in the modern game. It's hosted by Mike Petriello and Matt Myers, and on this week's show, they celebrate the arrival of pitchers and catchers with a breakdown of the pitchers they are most excited to watch this year, including the likes of Chris Sale and Marcus Stroman. You can download it on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcast by searching for StatCast Podcast. It is really cool stuff. StatCast is really cool stuff and kind of a natural fit. If you are into what we talk about here, then you will almost certainly not only be entertained but find value in learning more about StatCast. So.
Yeah, I feel this offseason, I feel more knowledgeable heading into this season than I have heading into any previous season because of the StatCast data that we've been able to digest during the offseason. So I really do think for serious fantasy owners, you know, taking the time to listen to that podcast every week can be really helpful because they're going to have data on there that you're not getting from other sources.
And so, as Fred talks about how prepared he felt, that plays into our next topic, which is the Labor Mixed League Draft, which you participated in. And a lot of interesting stuff in there. I'd first be curious to just think, you know, again, I'm always interested in how the trends you see broadly from sitting in a draft and looking at results. What kind of broad trends did you take from how experts approached one of the country's best-known mixed league drafts?
Yeah, I do feel in the labor league used to be really hitter heavy. Last season and this season, I'm starting to see experts put more value once again on early round pitchers, and that happened enough again this year. I think it could have happened even more, but I am starting to see a little more urgency to get one of those top five or six pitchers because the lower end aces are a little sketchy. You do see, though, as you go across the draft board, you know, all kinds of different philosophies. Owners who didn't spend much on closers, owners who spent a lot on closers, owners who didn't draft a pitcher for three or four rounds, and then others, you know, Alan Harrison from the Fantasy Fix picks Mike Trout first overall, but then picks Syndergaard and Sale with his next two picks. So it really is interesting to see how so many people who work in this industry and think about this stuff all day had a totally different plan for how to build a team.
You had the number 8 overall pick, which is an interesting place to be because it means you never get that bam bam 2 picks in a row or 2 picks in a short range. So it does affect strategy. You start with Max Scherzer, a guy we talked about. It's actually funny. You look at this, 8, 9, 10, Scherzer, Harper, Turner, a question we talked about, exactly those three guys at exactly that spot last week. So, hey, maybe we know something, or at least you know something. First of all, you take Scherzer 8 overall. Is that a hard call at all, or are you just happy to get that safe and high upside ace right there?
Yeah, picking 8th was interesting, and I didn't really like it in the sense of I looked at so many completed drafts before this draft started, and the same 7 players go in some order in the first 7 picks in almost every draft. Trout, Kershaw, Betts, Arenado, Altuve, Goldschmidt, Bryant. In some order, they're going to go. And sure enough, they went in some order in this draft. So I almost knew that I was going to draft Scherzer before the draft started. I thought hard about Trey Turner. I'm really intrigued by his upside for this season and his ability to fill the steals right from round 1. But in the end, I took Scherzer with kind of a plan to build a pitching staff around him because I felt like to get Turner, I really need him to be spectacular. With Scherzer, he's always spectacular. I just need Scherzer to be Scherzer for at least one more year for the pick to work out.
When you look at building a team and building a team as a whole, that 8 pick, as you know, is kind of an interesting place. How much do you consider at all? Is it even the slightest consideration when you pick again? So if you're picking 8th in a 12-team league, you go again in 9 spots. If you're picking 8th in a 15-team league, it's a lot longer than that. So is there any pressure? Does it change anything that you know your next pick? There are certain guys that you know there's no chance you can pair with Scherzer when you pick 8.
Yeah, no, that has to come into your thinking. The more I draft over the years, the more, though, I really feel like every draft that every fantasy owner does is entirely dictated by how you decide to build your pitching staff. Because those few picks mean so much as far as you're going to need at least a couple really good starters. You're going to need some closers unless you've already made the decision to punt saves. So, like those 3 or 4 picks of your first 2 starters, your top couple closers, like when you decide you want to pick them, everything else kind of falls in place around that. So if I decided to get Scherzer, which meant kind of dictated that I needed to take hitters with the next, you know, 2 or 3 picks. Whereas if I had taken Trey Turner in the first round, that leaves me, you know, without one of those top 5 or 6 pitchers and means that I'm going to have to get maybe even 2 now really good pitchers in the next, say, 4 picks. So I find everything kind of stems from the plan you make. Once you know your draft spot, then the plan you make for your pitching staff.
And that ties into something else we want to talk about, which is that by the end of round 6, you had 3 pitchers, 2 of whom were relievers. By the end of round 7. Kenley Jansen in 5, Edwin Diaz in 7. That was a strategy of yours, yes?
Yeah, definitely. There's been so much turnover at the closer position in recent years, and when I think about relievers and just step back from a practical perspective, there's 2 ways that they don't return the value that you wanted from them. They either get hurt or they lose their job. And if you take Kenley Jansen, you've taken out 50% of that risk right away because he's never going to lose his job. And I feel like Diaz is pretty much there. Also, I kind of had a plan with the strikeouts category. Scherzer's going to give you a 30 or 40, maybe even a 50 strikeout edge over a lot of teams' aces in your league. And then Jansen's going to give you a 20 or 30 strikeout edge over the number 1 closer for a lot of the teams in your league. And Diaz is going to give you the same edge over their number 2 closer. So now you've built anywhere from a 70 to 90 strikeout advantage from those 3 pitcher spots, which then allows you at the bottom end of your staff to use a 3rd reliever and not have to worry about strikeouts or to not have to really chase risky 2-start pitchers during the season.
A couple other things I wanted to ask you about from this before we move on. Matt Kemp in round 6 feels aggressive to me, and it certainly indicates that you are a believer in him. What has you so optimistic about Kemp?
Yeah, I mean, he had really good power numbers last season. His power numbers were pretty consistent whether he was in San Diego or Atlanta. As you mentioned, you know, we already talked about with Atlanta opening the new park, I think that he'll probably be in a better hitting environment this season than he was last season. And I really like the direction the Braves lineup is going. So if he can be a 30-homer player again this year, I think the RBI total and the run score total, you know, will both be nice. Now, a couple days later, they talked about him losing some weight and maybe that he could steal some bases. That really wasn't any of my thinking. It was more, I feel pretty confident that I can get 30 homers and 90 RBIs from him.
And you didn't take your first, at least primary third baseman, until round 23 with Trevor Plouffe. That hard to do at all? Was it hard to hold off? Were there ever any points where you started getting nervous there?
A little bit. If this league didn't have trades, then I probably would have picked a third baseman earlier. But I tend to trade a fair amount. I feel like I can get a third baseman in a trade if I need to. I actually drafted Curtis Granderson as a reserve outfielder before I drafted Plouffe. So that was part of, I didn't like the third base value later on in the draft. Just the ones that I wanted were going before I wanted to take them. So my decision was take Granderson. That can I think Granderson in a 15-team league should be in a starting lineup. So that would allow me to have the flexibility to trade one of my other five outfielders for a third baseman at some point. And Plouffe's just kind of, for me, is just a placeholder for the beginning of the season. Maybe someone will emerge in spring training and I can pick him up off waivers right at the start of the year. But if not, I mean, I don't have great hopes for Plouffe. I could see him hitting 16 or 17 home runs this year. But, you know, he can handle third base for me for a couple weeks or a month before I can figure something else out.
You took a couple of late-round guys that I like a lot, a couple of guys I will have my eye on draft day, and Mike Foltynewicz and Lucas Duda. A couple guys I would hate to count on, but sure love the possibility there. Either of those guys particularly high, or are they just kind of guys that happen to be the right guy at the right spot?
No, I found I tend to be the Lucas Duda guy in a lot of my leagues. I found even when he was going well, I really liked him. And now that things went poorly for him last year, I feel like nobody wants him. I've had done two drafts that I'm keeping like for the season, not just mock drafts, and I ended up with Duda late in both, and no one else really wanted him. I think he's worth that flyer late because if he's healthy, he's a 25-homer player. And Foltynewicz, yeah, I see some positive signs from him from last season, and I think he's a nice, really, really cheap late-round pitcher, and with where I took him in round 24, and then I took some guys later like Bartolo Colon and Steven Wright, like, I'm not counting on Foltynewicz. It would be awesome if I could use him every week, but he's kind of in that pile of guys for me who will fill out my last one or two pitching spots each week, so I can just kind of play the matchups at the beginning and then see how he starts the season, but I do think there's some breakout potential there.
Yeah, I think, look, I want to be clear, I don't see him as an ace type, but I think that the upside for him is really high. I think that, you know, he could be a legit 2-3 guy this year. I'm not betting on that. I don't think the odds are in favor of him going that far. But I think there is, you draft him with the idea that if everything breaks right, you could get a really nice pick there.
That's right. And I think, even if he doesn't ascend this season, just with him being in the National League and with his skill set, as long as he's healthy, I don't think he's someone who's going to pitch so poorly that I drop him. Like, I do think I'll be able to mix and match him, you know, use him the weeks he's playing the Phillies and things like that. I'm hoping for more, but I'm not counting on it. He ended up being, you know, my ninth pitcher that I took. So he's in that group of players that I can afford to move in and out of my lineup.
And one last thing to note, just overall, I was advocating, I believe last week, that I had Madison Bumgarner closer to the bottom of Tier 1 than to the rest of Tier 2. The experts do not agree with me. Scherzer goes 8, and then Bumgarner and Kluber go back-to-back. So I just thought that was interesting, as much as anything, how high Kluber went. But that pairing I thought was intriguing because, to me, that's an easy call for me. If those two guys are on the board, that's an easy call. I take Bumgarner in a heartbeat over Kluber, but I thought it was intriguing that they go back-to-back.
Yeah, but then there was a gap of about 10 picks before the next pitcher went, and then Syndergaard and Sale went back-to-back, and then there was another long stretch until David Price went. And I think, I think even probably the person who took Kluber would say that they would much rather have Bumgarner. A lot of it does come down to those pre-draft plans, I think, especially in the early rounds of an experts draft. And I think it was just that a lot of the owners in there had decided that they were starting with two hitters, except for the guy who took Kluber. Like, when he took Kluber, he probably assumed that Syndergaard, Sale were coming off the board soon. In the end, they went for a few more picks, and people didn't want them right away.
We now move on to our outfield preview. A reminder, the MLB.com Fantasy Player Preview is up. You should go check it out. There is a ton of information there. And once again, the outfield, the top of the outfield kind of looks a little like the top of starting pitchers, wherein there is guy number one, there's guy number two who we put in tier one with him, but it's still pretty clear who's one and two, and then there's a gap. And with outfield, it is Mike Trout and Mookie Betts. But as I say that, I'm not entirely sure the gap between one and two is that big. How far apart do you have Trout and Betts?
Yeah, I mean, Trout and Betts, they're tier one at outfield, and to me, they're basically also tier one of hitters in general. I think that they should be the first two hitters to go in pretty much every draft. I mean, I wouldn't argue against a Chris Bryant or an Altuve going second. Like, it's fine if someone sees an optimistic view there and wants to take them. But, yeah, for me, they should be the first two picks in your draft unless you're in a league that really heavily values starting pitching and someone wants to take Kershaw in one of those spots. But other than that, I think they should go first or second. I can make the case, too. I would take Trout out of the two. But I could easily make the case for Betts. Like, he is in a much superior lineup. You know, he was better than Trout for a fantasy perspective last season. So, and he's young. So, I mean, I couldn't argue with with taking Betts number one overall.
Yeah, I think this is sort of the interesting thing about these two guys is that Trout is so safe. I mean, you take his worst everything over the past 5 years, and you've got 287. 27 homers, 90 RBI, 11 steals, and 104 runs. That's his worst of every category over the past 5 years. Not his worst season, but like the baseline, the absolute baseline. That's great. That's really, really good. I think the thing about Trout is that there are some heights that I am more confident in Betts' ability to reach. And that would primarily be, I think I have more faith, even though Trout had more steals last year, as they move into their primes, I think I have more faith in Betts delivering some sort of stupid steal number than I do Trout delivering some sort of stupid steal number. And I might actually like Betts' chances of hitting 320, 330 more than I like Trout's chances of hitting 320, 330. We are parsing very fine lines here, but I think I like Trout's floor a little more and Betts' ceiling a little more. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally, and I would also say that now that Betts, I should hit probably third or fourth in the Red Sox lineup, I can see Betts possibly giving producing an RBI total that Trout, just with his lineup, can't really touch. Like, Betts, if Betts drove in 130 runs, I wouldn't be completely shocked. Trout's awesome, but I just don't know in that lineup if anyone could drive in 130 runs. I mean, if Trout and Betts switch teams, I think the gap between them to me would be huge. But where they are, I think it's pretty close.
We move to Tier 2, and whereas I made a case last week that the guy at the top of Tier 2 was close to Tier 1, I can't make that case this week. Bryce Harper, Trey Turner, Charlie Blackmon, Starling Marte, George Springer. We talked about Harper a lot. We talked about Turner a lot. The guy who I think I'm most interested in this group is Starling Marte, because I think there is potential for kind of a poor man's Betts there. He's the kind of guy, I don't think he's going to hit 30, but he hit 19 2 years ago, and he's young. You know, nobody's going to be shocked if this guy hits 20, 22 home runs, steals a ton of bases, hits for average. I think, aside from Harper, he's the guy who I feel like maybe most likely to be a real five-category star.
Yeah, I could see that. He's hitting too many ground balls right now. He'll have to change that approach a little bit. And I actually considered him as a second-round option in that labor draft this week. His games played scared me off a little bit. He had 129 last year. The year before, 153, which is great, but the two previous years, each 135. So he's playing plenty of games. He's not having the, like, 80-game season that really everybody notices. But every season, there's just a few things that happen that seem to cause him to miss about 30 games. So if he could get past that, hit a few more fly balls, you're right. We could see a home run total in the 20s. And if he can keep his steals total up around 40, then we've got something really special.
Anybody else in that group? I mean, again, with the exception of Harper, who we've talked about extensively, Blackmon, Springer, either of those guys you kind of have a personal feeling about?
No, I find I'm usually the low man on Springer in my drafts. I with the strikeouts, I'm not sure if the batting average can ever be really high, and he hasn't really developed into a really good base stealer. So I'm kind of the low man on him. I get that he's certainly a really good fantasy asset. Turner's going to be one of the people that I'm going to watch as closely as anyone in baseball this year, because I just think he's the guy, even maybe including Harper, who could actually, if he has the year that he could, like his best year, could be in the top three or four fantasy picks next year. Like if he hits 300 and steals 50 bases this year with even a little power, then we're going to be talking about him early in the first round next year.
Yeah, I am with you on Springer. I'm not really crazy about the performance that we've actually seen. I understand what could be, but haven't really seen the performance so far. And in fact, if I'm at a place where he's on the board, I am maybe looking at another option and thinking about these third tier guys, because there's some guys I really like in this bunch: Cespedes, Nelson Cruz, JD Martinez, Ian Desmond, Christian Yelich, Gregory Polanco, and Ryan Braun. And I think the guy I want to talk about from here is Yelich, because I think he's another one of those guys that, to some extent, when coming up, maybe didn't look like a budding star. He looked like he was going to be a very good player, a guy you could plug into your lineup and be happy about. But he hits 21 home runs last year, busts his walk total back up again, steals, only 9 steals. But I think we all know he's capable of, more than that. I doubt he gets to 20 again. But I feel like he's a guy who, in a sneaky good lineup, can help you in a lot of ways, and he's somebody I really have my eye on because he's not flashy, but he kind of helps you across the board.
Yeah, I really like Yelich. One thing that's pretty cool about him, and it's interesting that we're talking about him today because we just talked about the StatCast podcast. When you look at his StatCast data, his average fly ball distance last season was the highest in baseball. So him busting up to 21 home runs is not that surprising. He's still hitting so many ground balls, but when he's putting the ball in the air, he's hitting it really hard. So if he can just keep, and he did make a little bit of progress towards hitting fewer ground balls last year, like if he can keep going in that direction with the way he's hitting the ball hard, it's really easy to see more than 25 home runs from him. And if he could do that and get a little bit of the steals back that dropped last year, and we're looking at 25-plus homers and 15 to 20 steals, and he seems to be consistently hitting around 300, now we've got something pretty cool from Tier 3.
And this is a guy who, coming up, I think the one thing that was said about him, the one thing that people thought was going to be special about him coming up, aside from his defense, was his ability to hit for average. This is a guy you repeatedly heard coming up, potential future batting champion. He's steadily hit 300 so far, but he's got a sweet stroke. He has a nice idea of the strike zone. He is one of those guys that you wouldn't be surprised at all to see a bump from 300 to, say, 320.
Yeah, I totally agree. From that third tier, I love that trio of power hitters at the beginning of it with Cespedes, Cruz, and Martinez. Like, I just think that's a really nice way to get probably 35-ish home runs and, 90, 100 RBIs. And then from the other three in that group, Desmond Yelich, Polanco, and Braun, like, I find Yelich really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. He's definitely my favorite of that bunch, and I'm kind of low man on Desmond. I wouldn't mind having him, but I'm not going to go out of my way to get him.
Yeah, it's hard to spend that much of a pick on a player where you really worry about the skill set, and that a lot of the reason you pick him is this new home park driven from him signing with the Rockies. Like, it just doesn't feel like an awesome reason to take a guy in the first 5 or 6 rounds of your draft.
And you start messing with a guy's position. Who knows what they're going to do with him? You start messing with a guy's position, and I worry about what effect that's going to have on his offense.
Yeah, it's possible, and it's a deep roster, and I mean he's got a big contract. I think they're going to give him a long rope, but there's a lot of pieces in that lineup. If he didn't get off to a good start, could he hit 7th or 8th? He often hit 6th or 7th when he was with the Nats. So, I mean, they just have a lot of other players: Story, LeMahieu, Blackman, Cargo, Arenado, who could all hit ahead of him. And now all of a sudden he's kind of hanging out with the catcher and the pitcher down at the bottom of the lineup, which isn't, again, what you really want to see from a guy you took in the 5th or 6th round of your draft.
Now we move, and I think it is fair to say that Tier 4 is by far the most interesting bunch of players.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of guys where, to some extent, at least half of these guys are Rorschach tests. It's just a question of what you see when you look at them. Billy Hamilton, A.J. Pollock, Matt Kemp, Giancarlo Stanton, Andrew McCutchen, Carlos Gonzalez, Justin Upton. I think every single guy on this list, with the possible exception of Hamilton, has been regarded as a first-round pick at some point in his career.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I even saw Hamilton last year, I think it was, or maybe the year before, going like in like the second round of some roto leagues, deeper, like 15-team roto leagues, from people hoping for that 80 or 85 steal season.
So the question, the kind of two questions with all of these guys are, one, how much of their former greatness can they regain? What percentage of what they've been in the past can they be? And two, how likely are they to do it? And I think out of that bunch, the guy where I like that combination the most is Stanton. He is still young. The tools are ridiculous. I think he's probably the guy that is most likely to get closest to what he once was. I mean, put it, I think he's the guy who can get the closest to what he once was. I don't know if he's the most likely, but I think he's high on that list. So I like him the most of that bunch. Is there anybody else you kind of view the same way out of that group?
Yeah, for me it's probably Pollock. It's interesting because we're talking about tier four of outfielders, and there's two guys, Pollock and Stanton, that were first-round picks in a lot of leagues just last season. I mean, and then McCutchen was 2 years ago, but just last season Pollock and Stanton were first-round picks. With Pollock, the reason I'm intrigued is we haven't really seen him do anything bad. Like last year, he just missed most of the season. He came back late, kind of didn't really do much, but it was late in the year. And, you know, and I think he's just kind of trying to get his feet wet again after being injured. So it's not like he's ever struggled since he had that amazing 2015 year. He was just injured. So it'll just be a question of how healthy he is. And it's a nice hitting environment with him in Arizona. Yeah, this is a really interesting boomer bust tier where, you know, the range of outcomes for players like Billy Hamilton, Pollock, Stanton. Stanton could hit 50 home runs this year and we wouldn't be surprised, or he could play 80 games and hit 20 and we wouldn't be really surprised either. And so this is, to me, that fourth tier is a little bit of a make-or-break tier for your fantasy team.
I would note that Stanton went 29 at the end of round two in the labor draft, so he's clearly a guy where the range of views on him is going to be very wide.
Yeah, for sure. We have him in tier four. There'll be one owner in every draft who kind of puts him into tier two or at least the top of tier three, where they just say, you know, this is the gamble that I'm going to take, is that he's going to stay healthy and hit 40-something home runs this season, and they're going to invest that really high pick. Because even at pick 29, if he does what a lot of people were predicting for him for several seasons, he could still outperform that pick. It's just that we've seen so many now in inconsistent and injury-plagued seasons.
And we've finally moved to Tier 5. And here, to some extent, I think it becomes a question of what you need, because there are some guys who offer really different things. Mark Trumbo, Adam Jones, Stephen Piscotty, Lorenzo Cain, Chris Davis with a K, Benintendi, Eaton, Bautista, and David Dahl. And so at this point, you kind of get to either sort of kind of solid all-around guys, a guy like Adam Jones who's not going to kill you in anything but may not be special in anything. I think Piscotty to some extent is in that same group. Or, you know, your low-average sluggers and a guy like Trumbo. Or guys like Eaton and Benintendi who aren't going to offer you a lot of power but who'll help you other ways. So to what extent for you, when you're looking at this point, are you looking at what you already have as much as the player himself?
Yeah, I think that this is, and that's the point probably in a draft too, where you're starting to hit the middle rounds. If I'm thinking back to my labor draft, you know, these guys were starting to go kind of like rounds 8, 9, 10, but that's a 15-team league. So if you're thinking 10 or 12-team league, now you're into double-digit rounds for all of them. You've already have several hitters. So now you're right. You start to think, do I have enough sluggers and I don't need a Mark Trumbo? I really could use a Lorenzo Cain type player. Or did I already draft Billy Hamilton or Trey Turner or something and I could really use a Bautista or a Trumbo? So it's definitely a tier where I think you have to look in two directions. One is, what do I need? But then the other thing is, you know, which of those players do you really feel good about? And I mean, all of us are going to have one or two players in that tier that really piqued our interest. I took Benintendi on Monday in the labor draft because I'm starting to really feel good about the possibility of him hitting second and doing really well for the Red Sox. I will say that by the time I took him, almost all of those other Tier 5 players were gone.
All right, well, that's the Fantasy 411 for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk, and we'll be back with you same time next week.